got a babe, but shall I keep him? 'Twill come the day when I'll be weeping.
You're listening to Coastline. I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn. November 10th, 1898, the date of the only recorded coup d'etat planned and carried out by white supremacists in the city of Wilmington, North Carolina. So far, we've examined what we know about the months leading up to the massacre. Now we're going to explore Wilmington post-coup, 120 years later. Earl Sheridan served on Wilmington City Council for 12 years, from 2005 to 2017. He's a retired professor from the Department of Public and International Affairs at the University of North Carolina, Wilmington. And earlier this year, Governor Roy Cooper bestowed upon him the state's highest honor, the Order of the Longleaf Pine. Earl Sheridan is a Wilmington native who left briefly to earn his bachelor's degree and PhD in political science. He's researched and published on political ideology and race. He was also president of the New Hanover County branch of the NAACP from 1987 to 1996, and he served on the 1898 Memorial Foundation and on the City Commission on African American History. He joins us now. Earl Sheridan, welcome to Coastline.
Thank you very much. I'm glad to be here.
Glad to have you here. And just a reminder, today's interview is pre-recorded. Earl Sheridan, we've heard so much now about how the fear among white supremacists of sex, frankly, with people of color was a driving force behind the massacre of 1898. You grew up in Wilmington many decades later. How much do you think had changed at that point?
At the time that I was growing up?
Yes.
I think a lot of things were very similar. Certainly, I think among the African-American population at that time, there was the impact of 1898, even in the 1960s, because people knew what had happened at that time. And some people said that there was a reticence among some African-Americans to strike out toward certain things because of the memory, the lingering memory of 1898. Now, I don't want to take that too far because I grew up at a time when there were demonstrations going on here and that kind of thing. So, it wasn't like no one was doing anything. We had an active civil rights movement here. But I know reading, for example, Dr. Hubert Eaton's book, Every Man Must Try, he talked about when he came here the sense of reticence among, he thought, some of the black population as far as striking out and doing things because of the lingering memory of 1898. Although no one really talked about it that openly, but the memory of it was still out there.
Do you remember when you first heard about 1898?
I do, and I didn't know it was 1898 when I heard about it, but there was an older woman who lived down the street from me. And she used to talk about the idea of the time when black people were killed and their bodies were thrown in the Cape Fear River and that kind of thing. And we didn't exactly know the context of what she was talking about, but she would talk about that kind of thing. And that was one of the first times I'd ever heard of 1898, not knowing that it was 1898. It was years later, actually, when I was in college, that I had some context put to it and heard about 1898 and knew exactly what she was talking about.
When she would talk about this, so you're a child, I'm assuming.
Yes, I was a child, yeah. Uh-huh.
This must be frightening to hear about this.
Well, it was frightening, and it was a scary time. You talk about the sexual context. I remember when I was a child, my mother saying to me, and I think this was kind of sort of in the wake of what had happened with Emmett Till in Mississippi and everything, but my mother said, she said, "Oh, down in Mississippi, if you look at a white woman, they'll kill you," or whatever it is. And so as a child, I took this, kind of literally. I thought, if you looked at somebody, somebody would do something to you and that kind of thing. But that fear and that feeling and that kind of thing was, you know, was out there.
When you think about the lessons that your parents taught you growing up as a resident in the city of Wilmington with that kind of history, and then you compare it to people that you met later, maybe when you went off to college. I guess you went to Appalachian, which is still North Carolina in the mountains, mm-hmm. and then you went to the University of Tennessee. In Knoxville. How different do you think your lessons were from your parents because of the history of Wilmington versus other people of color that grew up in other parts of the country?
My lessons were probably similar to most Southern blacks. I would imagine across the South, people telling their kids in some way or another similar kinds of things. It's what you hear now when people talk about the talk that they have with their kids about how to deal with police and a police stop. And, you know, all kind of black people all over the country or whatever probably have similar conversations with their kids. And so I would imagine that what I had heard from my parents was not too much different from what other Southern black kids felt. Now, you know, it may have been different in some of the northern urban areas or things like that, but I would say the lessons of black Southerners was probably similar.
Why did you decide after you earned your PhD to come back to Wilmington?
Well, it was just fortuitous, actually. As I was finishing up my PhD, someone put a notice in my box that there was a job opening at UNCW. And it was in my area. It was in my very area, political theory. And so I applied for it. And actually, I turned down another sure job that I had with the hope that I would get it. And I got it. And so I liked the idea of coming back to my hometown. You know, my family was here. And I did hope that I could come back and perhaps contribute and make some sort of difference in my town.
Do you feel like you've been able to do that where certainly you have? I mean, just having received the Order of the Longleaf Pine from the governor, you know, your list of accomplishments is long. When it comes to race relations and the existing racial divide in the city of Wilmington in 2018, how much progress do you think we've made?
Well, there are people who like to say that we haven't made any progress, but I know that that's not true. We've made significant progress. The fact that there are black people serving and having served on some of our governing boards and that kind of thing, the fact that I was actually on city council at all. When I was a child here, there weren't any black people on any of the governing boards. We've made progress in a lot of ways. These are not the days of Jim Crow, as was the case when I was growing up here. We still have a ways to go as far as everything is concerned.
What are some of the specific areas that you think really need improvement here? Like, if you could just stack them up and label them and say, look at this.
Education. I think the basically we have in certain ways a dual school system here. We have some schools that are basically the students are low income and minority schools and they aren't performing as well as some of the other schools. I think education is something that we could use improvement on. We can use improvement on, and this doesn't just affect African Americans, but, you know, affordable housing in our area. And, of course, the storm has exacerbated that situation. And so, these are areas. I'd like to see more African American businesses in our area. These are all things. These are just a few of the things that if I thought long, I could probably think of others that that we could use some change in here.
You mentioned education and the fact that there is a link between high minority population schools, high poverty schools, and low performing schools. A lot of people would just say the system in New Hanover County is highly segregated. Would you characterize it that way? And if so, what's the answer to that?
Yes, I think it is. I think it is highly segregated. I would say, of course, it's segregated for a lot of reasons. You know, the school board back, I think in the 90s, made a decision to go away from trying to have a diverse school system. They went toward this idea of neighborhood schools, which leads to a separate school system. I think we could do more as far as residential in our residential areas to have them be more integrated and things of that nature.
How could we do that?
A lot of it has to do with zoning and where people can afford to live and has to do with housing. You know, when we do affordable housing, the thing in the past is to have these affordable housing all clumped in one area or that kind of thing. And I think we should have affordable and workforce housing kind of sprinkled in our various areas. We shouldn't have these concentrated areas of poverty in which basically there are minority people that live there. We should do what we can to not try to have concentrated areas of poverty.
So when it comes to policymaking, the education piece is interconnected with zoning and affordable housing.
Yes, it is.
You're listening to Coastline. The 120th anniversary of the only coup d'etat on American soil is November 10th. The massacre took place in Wilmington, North Carolina. My guest right now is professor, political scientist, former city councilman, and Wilmington native Earl Sheridan. Today's discussion is pre-recorded. You talk about coming back to Wilmington because you got a job in political science at UNCW, and you had family and a support system here. I've heard that professional people of color who've been raised in other places have moved here, stayed for a little while, gotten a look around, seen the Confederate monuments framing downtown, gotten a load of the street names, some of which are named after Confederate soldiers, even, you know, white supremacists, say no thanks and flee. Is that urban legend, or are you aware of that?
I think there are black professionals who have come here and left. I don't think the main reason they've left is the street names or that kind of thing. What I hear black people say is that there's nothing to do here. There's nothing here for black people. There's not the entertainment venues and the various things where they can go to and feel necessarily good about those things. If you're a Southern black person, you probably come from another. If you come from Atlanta or Richmond or wherever, you've probably seen Confederate monuments and streets named after Confederates. I think Wilmington needs to have more to offer African Americans as far as a quality of life and those kinds of things. I think those are the reasons that people leave, not necessarily because of the monuments or the street names, although I don't think those are necessarily great things, but I don't think that those are the things that cause people to leave.
Okay, so as an adult, you kind of push that over into this is a more superficial issue that may or may not represent things, but it doesn't affect my quality of life.
Mm-hmm.
However, when we talked about Confederate monuments specifically on a different discussion, and I asked you how you felt as a child looking up at those statues and what they said to you, It was different. You said you think it sent a message to you.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And actually, it probably sent a message more to me when I got older and was ready and could really understand the meaning of it at that particular time. So yeah, I mean, I'm not going to say that doesn't have an impact, but I don't think that's the reason that black people would leave here. I think it's a larger aspect than that.
How could this area move forward in terms of developing things that would attract more people of color to this area? I mean, what is there to do there?
I think that's one of the reasons why I was talking about the idea of the development of black businesses and maybe more networking and things of that nature to appeal to people, particularly to the younger African American crowd that might be coming into town. And someone mentioned, I was actually talking to a group of people about this the other day, just informally, and they were talking about, you know, a nice jazz club or something of that nature. That's not necessarily a hip hop place, but a place where a jazz club where some folks might want to meet and that kind of thing, and that African Americans can feel really comfortable in and that kind of thing. That's what I hear oftentimes when I hear about people coming here. My wife, I've heard people talk about you get black people here, they don't necessarily crazy about the beach, but there's other things they want to do. And so I think we need other things to draw them here.
And that's this special edition of Coastline. Professor Earl Sheridan, thank you so much for being with us today.
Sure.
Thanks also to John Jeremiah Sullivan, Joel Finsel, and WHQR reporter Vince Winkle. Coastline is a production of WHQR Public Media. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline.